I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Wyandotte County is in for a political shakeup. Voters ousted current mayor and CEO Mark Holland in favor of David Alvey. Meanwhile, at polls in Kansas City, Missouri, residents overwhelmingly approved big changes for the airport. Today, a conversation about what Tuesday's election results mean on both sides of the state line. Then, antibiotic-resistant bacteria is not just the stuff of apocalyptic movies. These germs are on the rise in the real world, too. We'll speak with a local researcher about her award-winning work battling these super bugs. Later, Brian McTavish returns with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The biggest upset in Tuesday's elections, that's an easy one. It was the election of David Alvey as the new mayor and CEO of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County. Alvey upset current mayor Mark Holland in a result that was all but inexplicable, at least for many people living outside of Kansas City, Kansas. Today we'll kick around how this happened and we'll run down what's next for KCI, what the results said about the prospects for independence given the outcome of a Lee Summit state Senate race, and what Tuesday's result meant for Democrats and Republicans across the country. With us now, Dave Helling is my partner in politics from the editorial board of the Kansas City Star. David, good morning.
Great to be with you, Steve, as always.
Mike Jacoby is known as one of the fathers of the consolidation of the Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas governments almost exactly 20 years ago. He's retired after working as a realtor. Mike, nice to have you too. Welcome here.
Thank you, Steve.
Mike, you live in Wyandotte County. What happened here? What was the impact of this election? What happened?
Well, it's really very simple. It's really not complicated, and it's not that meaningful. Wyandotte County's had a renaissance for 20 years. It's the pride of the nation. We're proud. We got respect. Everybody knows that about the true renaissance. What happened was that there was a disagreement in the direction of the fire department. Mayor Holland had a tough negotiation with them, and they ran a masterful campaign, the likes of which I've never seen.
Getting out the vote against Mayor Mark Holland.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there was several other things, but we had a degree of complacency because we did so well in the primary. And I say we, Mark Holland. I wasn't a part internally of his campaign, but I talked to him and I talked to all the people in the campaign.
And you voted for him.
Oh, I advocated. Social media, everything I could do. I love the guy. But we had a certain degree of complacency because we did so well in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And that usually wins the election.
David, how big of an upset was this from your vantage point?
On a scale of 1 to 10, a 7 maybe. I think we all thought that Mayor Holland had done a fairly good job in his first term. He had not faced major scandal. Wyandotte County, at least in some places, was on the upswing. So, I think that we were unaware of what David Alvey was doing to sort of, get his name and profile out into the community. He is well known in the county. His family is well known. And I think that Mike is right. The spat, if you will, with the fire department may have escaped our broad notice because we just don't cover Wyandotte County as much as we used to, but it clearly played a role, and that was clear even 2 or 3 months ago. And in most communities, as you know, Steve, when the fire folks get upset, it can swing votes, and it certainly did in Kansas City, Kansas.
And Mike, you've said that this election may not wind up being that big of a deal. Why do you say that?
Well, we've had this renaissance, and Mark Holland bought in $3 billion in new investment. He bought in 12,000 jobs. He ran with the most integrity of anybody I've ever known. His administration was that way. Who's going to change that? There's not going to be a change. Mm-hmm. And David Alvey loves this community. Mm-hmm. It was just a difference in the direction of the fire department. It boils down to that.
Because the firefighters got out, went door to door, and campaigned aggressively for David Alvey. Am I hearing you right?
The likes of which you've never seen. And let me say this about Mark Holland, and the firefighters really should appreciate this. He never campaigned against him. There was things that he could have said. He ran, I have his cards here. He ran a positive campaign on what he accomplished, but he at no time, except in the debates, which only nerds listen to, he at no time publicized that the cost of our fire is double mm-hmm. of local communities. He could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
He could have talked about Bob Wing not working. He's the union guy. He never worked a day last year and received $120,000 as a firefighter through some shift trading.
I'll have to give him a chance to respond to that sometime. Yeah,
It's legal, but the community wouldn't have liked it. Mark could have ran a campaign, and he could have won that campaign. But I don't think he ran it the way that see, we had some complacency. We thought we were going to be okay anyway. But the biggest thing for Mark, I think, was the honor of the community not getting into that kind of a fight.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been harmful for the community.
Mike, where do you think David Alvey is going to take the county? What are his priorities going to be going forward?
It's the same. It's you want development, you want jobs, you want good things, and he loves the community, and I'm sure he'll do all of that. The only change is going to be internally in the direction of the fire department. Last time I saw David Alvey, I was floating in a swimming pool drinking scotch with him. I like the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my best friends worked hard for him. I love him, and we still get along, and we always will.
You know, Mike, one of Mayor Holland's big initiatives has been this healthy campus around 10th and Minnesota. It's a YMCA complex along with a grocery store there. The groundbreaking was said to occur maybe in the springtime. At least that's what the mayor was saying during the campaign. Do you expect David Alvey to continue the push for the healthy campus downtown?
I don't have any knowledge of that, but I don't know why he wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me just say one thing about the firefighters, because, you know, if I support their opposition, someone might think that I don't respect them. I flew helicopters in Vietnam for 2.5 years. I flew in the Army for 23 years, and I've seen a lot of men burned to death.
Mm-hmm.
There's an emotional relationship I have with the firefighters that your listeners or they probably wouldn't comprehend, but there's no animosity from the mayor and the firefighters, or it was just a policy difference.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the public and the surrounding communities, there's no other meaning to this.
Yeah. You know, there's also a lot of concern about, can the new mayor bring some of the wealth and success that Western Wyandotte County has enjoyed out of the Legends, and can he bring and transfer some of that wealth to the eastern side of the county that hasn't seen as much growth? Is that possible?
Well, it's tough, and it's the big issue, but, you know, people who complained about consolidation, there's going to be some disgruntled people. They didn't pave my road with gold, but the urban core across every city in the United States has got challenges.
Mm-hmm.
We're equipping ourselves with the tools to deal with those challenges. It takes money and it takes taxes, and we've brought in, I don't remember the numbers, $12 million in new taxes. That's money you can apply to everything.
Mm-hmm. Dave Helling from The Star, you know, one of the things we struggled with on the editorial board was this idea that David Alvey, as a candidate, was talking about taking care of this $500 million list of deferred maintenance projects in the county. At the same time, he was talking about tax cuts and increasing the pace there. You sort of wonder, how do you square those two ideas going forward in an Alvey administration?
Well, yes, you do, and they are not compatible. I mean, there is a backlog of work that needs to be done on public facilities in the county and in the city, and the complaints about property tax rates and payments in the city are very real and continue. And David Alvey, as in essence, said, we'll devote more of our money from other places to reduce that burden. And so, if he's serious about addressing that backlog, he'll have to come up with a plan fairly quickly to do so. Now, you know, whether he submits that to voters, whether he has members of the commission that will help him out or not is not completely clear. But, you know, Kansas City, Kansas has struggled for many, many years with maintaining what it has, primarily because of a deteriorating tax base. That is less of a problem now than it used to be. And the opportunity, therefore, sits in his lap and his colleagues' lap to try and address some of the problems the county has.
You know, Mike Jacoby, just a final point here, this notion that there's going to be a new day at City Hall, a new tone, you're shaking your head and saying you don't think that's going to be the case.
I don't think it's going to be the case because what people really need to understand is that David Alvey goes into this thing with a strong mayor form of government, and most people don't understand that, but he has executive authority. He hires and fires the administrator. He has veto authority. He can run the government, and that's what's made us successful. It's the structure of our government. There's no magic solutions, but we have the tools to deal with it. The tools are going to be given to his hand, and he will move forward. I'm confident of it.
That's Mike Jacoby. He's known as one of the fathers of the consolidation movement in Kansas City, Kansas, that brought county and city governments together 20 years ago. Mike, thanks for taking some time and coming over today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Dave Helling with the Star is going to stick with me here for a little bit. David, let's turn to that big state Senate race in Lee's Summit that was on the ballot Tuesday. I want to ask specifically about the performance of an independent candidate in that race, Jacob Turk. He's been a regular candidate for Congress in Missouri's 5th District, running against Emanuel Cleaver any number of cycles, I think six in a row now. So he was pretty well known. In this race, he ran as an independent, but got only 7 or 8% of the vote. I'm wondering, what do you make of that, and what does that say about the prospects for independent candidates up and down the ballot? Because obviously, Greg Orman in Kansas is thinking about, at least he's said to be thinking right. about, an independent run for governor of Kansas next year.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can take, perhaps you agree with me, but I'm not sure we can take too much of a lesson from this election in the 8th District. Primarily because Jacob Turk is kind of a unique individual. I mean, he's run for office many, many times. He's relatively well known. He ran as a Republican in those races. And so the exposure of the three-way race out there may have distorted the outcome. People knew what was going on and didn't see him as a true independent. Now, having said that, globally, Steve, and I think you do agree with me on this, independent candidates really face an uphill battle. I mean, let alone the party dominance of ballot access and the stuff you have to do. It's just hard for an independent to find a space to get traction in races like a Kansas governor's race or a Senate race because the two parties are so adept at co-opting points of view and arguments, and it just makes it harder for someone to run as an independent, and therefore they have to have a unique story. You know, Greg Orman ran as a businessman and not beholden to interest, but people made him out to be a Democrat anyway, as you recall in 2014 in Kansas. So I think he's still looking at running in the race. I think they want to make a point about independence, but if we learn anything from Missouri 8, it's that it's a tough race is made even tougher if you go as an independent.
We've got Dave Helling for about 8 more minutes. If you want to join our conversation with a question about what happened locally or nationally in Tuesday's elections here and across the country, 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's turn to the national picture for a moment, David. I mean, do Tuesday's results suggest gloom and doom for Republicans next year, or is that reading too much into this thing?
Well, I don't, gloom and doom may be too much, but they've got to be worried. How would you like to be Kevin Yoder today, for example? I mean, Kevin Yoder is the classic Republican in a House seat who might be the target of some Democratic, money and energy in 2018 because of the erosion, the apparent erosion of suburban support for sort of mainstream or more moderate Republicans, and that fits Kevin Yoder to a T. I mean, his district, was not a big Trump district in Kansas, and he's got to be worried about that a little bit. More broadly, does it change the picture in Missouri with Josh Hawley and Claire McCaskill? I'm not sure. Virginia suggests a path for a Democrat, but I think local on the ground conditions will also play a role. in big statewide races like that. So I think Democrats in the House nationally, Republicans in the House nationally are a bit nervous today because of what happened in Virginia. A broader reading, I don't think, is the good way to go.
You know, having said this, Democrats all but had to win that big governor's race in Virginia, or today we'd be saying their prospects for next year were gloomy and doomy, right? I mean,
yes, and the ground, again, in Virginia is favorable to a Democrat statewide increasingly. Virginia is going in the opposite direction of Missouri. You know, Missouri used to be sort of moderate Democratic and has over the last 20 years moved further and further into red territory, and Virginia has moved in the exact opposite direction. Virginia and Missouri are very similar states, by the way, a couple of large urban areas with a big rural population, but those urban areas are growing and provide the Democrats with the votes. You're right, had the Democrats lost in Virginia, there would be wailing and gnashing of teeth all up and down the Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. They didn't lose it. They held the seat they needed to hold. And I do think there is energy on the Democratic side driven by anger at President Trump. But again, I don't know how translatable that is to the Missouri Senate race, or for that matter, the Kansas governor's race. That may be determined on specific state issues that are not necessarily related to Donald Trump.
Dave Helling from The Star is my guest. We're talking politics both locally and nationally. Our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls for Dave and Leslie from Mission Hills. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning. Jason Hancock had a great piece in the paper today about what we were talking about a few minutes ago on the 8th Senate district race. And what I think Dave Helling just missed a little bit in the conversation on air is this whole idea of the dark money, irrespective of independent, because you could make the case that Turk really didn't draw so much away necessarily from Hillary. I mean, there's no question you could make a case that Serp Poe was going to make his bid successful. But with that dark money coming in and the fear that was generated by this three-way thing, it isn't just independents who are affected. And I think the unintended consequences of the quote-unquote reform in the Missouri law last year is something that needs to be revisited, because is what is influencing this race more than anything.
Really good point, Dave. And as you know, voters a couple of years ago in Missouri passed this new law that limited the size of campaign donations. Jason Hancock in The Star writes today that the money is flowing in a new way, and that's what Leslie's talking about here.
Yeah, and she's exactly right. And she's right. We should not discount the impact of all that last-minute money in the 8th District, dark money, unidentifiable money. In fact, some Democrats will say, you know, the $1 million or whatever it turned out to be that was spent over there is actually good for them because it sucks some of the fundraising out of other races where that money might go. But I will say this, if you're worried about dark money donations and dark money unidentified contributions for campaign ads, you'd better strap in, because in the Senate race, independent spending could top $100 million, particularly if the overall control of the Senate is close. Missouri will be ground zero in that. And the Kansas governor's race, if Kris Kobach is the nominee, you'll look for all kinds of dark money coming in. That cat has really out of the bag. And we've written about this, Steve, as you know, on the editorial board. It's disgusting and disturbing, but it's not going to change anytime soon.
Dave, I just want to slow you down here for a moment, because you mentioned a couple of interesting things. This idea, we just had a state Senate race on the Missouri side in Lee Summit, and you just mentioned that hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe $1 million, was spent in that race for a state Senate seat. Dave, is that where the world is turning right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, you and I have both. I mean, that's amazing and probably overkill. And I think probably the fear was that had Hillary Shields won that race, that it would be seen as a larger indication that Republicans are in trouble in the state. Remember that district is very, very Republican.
Yes.
Hasn't elected a Democrat in many, many years. And you see some of that in Virginia, don't you? The Virginia House of Delegates, I think, elected at last count 14 Democrats to take Republican seats. And part of the narrative you're hearing nationally is the Democrats are on the ascendance because of those races. And I think that this, had she won, this would have stuck out a little bit. And so Republicans were just desperate to hold on to the seat, and there was plenty of money available. And, you know, this is the state of Missouri where cash sloshes around in elections as a regular thing. She did, you know, let's just give her some due. She did much better. I think she lost by 8 points. Maybe it was 50-42. Yeah. I didn't see the final results. But much better than a Democrat would be expected to do in that district, especially against nearly $1 million in spending. So she ran a great campaign. It was a tough climb, and I think the Republicans responded for that reason.
Matt from Baldwin City. Matt, you're on with Dave Helling. Good morning.
Good morning. This is a very, very good discussion. I wanted to ask, and I've been wondering about this, and I thought, and this would be the perfect panel to put this question in front of. How do these recent returns from the state elections nationally affect the potential specter of a constitutional convention being called?
There was a referendum, I think, in New York. About a state constitutional convention that the voters rejected. So the idea of sort of re-examining foundational documents was out there in this cycle. I do think if you're talking about a constitutional convention for the national constitution, I do think there is some momentum from that in red states, and I didn't know there was going to be a test, but I think Kansas may have considered a resolution to do that. But broadly speaking, I don't think that a constitutional convention, a national constitutional convention, is likely anytime soon.
Dave, just a final point here before you go here. Let's turn to KCI. Why did it win by so much? 75% in an election that a lot of us thought was going to be a whole lot closer than that.
Yeah, I don't think any of us, Steve, were surprised at the outcome. But everyone was shocked at a 75-25 margin. I wrote a bit of a column about this in today's newspaper. My argument is that I think the airport is more broadly popular with the public than we know. I mean, I think we all believe that somehow 40% or 38% of the public supported a new airport for many months. I think the actual figure was probably higher than that. You just don't go from 40 to 75 in a six-week period when the fundamentals of an election don't really change. I do think that the campaign was very talented, did a great job, and, you know, knew their voters and who to target. And by the way, the opposition just didn't do well. I mean, they don't have a lot of money. They don't make great arguments. It's a very loose, unorganized coalition, so there wasn't really a real pushback. And then I think you believe, and others believe, that Mayor Sly James deserves a good deal of credit.
I do.
He was
yeah.
out front in the commercials, did his thing, and that certainly played a role, certainly. There'll be some disagreement about what happened back in May and June when there was so much fighting about who would get the contract and Burns and McDonald's role and no bid contracts and chaos and all of that. And we'll argue about that for some time. But at the end, you know, the mayor is a good closer, and he was able to close on this proposal, you know, well and quickly. And one other thing, how about the Northland? I mean, you know, it's a axiom of Kansas City politics that the Northland folks are skeptical about big projects and don't like taxes.
Not this time.
They went not this time at all. And there's a suggestion that the Northland itself may be changing a little bit away from the sort of anti-tax standpoint they've had for so long and being more like the rest of Kansas City, which will make the city more homogenous politically going forward.
That's Dave Helling from the Kansas City Star's editorial board. David, thanks very much.
You bet. My pleasure, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll meet the woman who's working to find a way to stop bacteria from resisting antibiotics. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we heard from the architect of the 10-year-old block building at the Nelson Atkins, and we looked at the factors driving up the number of mega fires raging across the country. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, a conversation about the Affordable Care Act and what a shorter enrollment period means for people needing health insurance. And we take a look at the options parents have when enrolling their kids in a Kansas City, Missouri public school. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the simple way to describe what Dr. Johanna Slutsky does is to say that she wants to find a way to stop bacteria from resisting antibiotics. As many of us know, a lot of our infections these days are resistant to antibiotics, and that can be a scary thing. Dr. Slutsky, who works at the University of Kansas, just received a $2.3 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to continue her work. It was the second major award she's received in the past year. Dr. Johanna Slutsky joins us now, and what a pleasure to have you here. Welcome. Thanks for coming over.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
And congratulations on the big honors.
Thank you.
Not bad.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
And these are game changers for you, Johanna?
Yeah. They allow me to expand my lab. So if you're listening and you're a biochemist or a microbiologist or...
How about a talk show host? Would you take someone like me?
Can't take a talk show host yet. We don't have the funding for that type of program, but maybe soon. But we're looking for talented people in the area to do research.
So what does a $2.3 million grant from the National Institutes of Health enable you to do?
It allows us to really expand the operation. It allows us to expand it, as I was saying before, personnel-wise, in terms of hiring a couple more graduate students, maybe a postdoc, an extra technician. So just more people doing the work. It allows us to get more equipment.
Yeah.
So we can get big $100,000 pieces of equipment to do work that will save time, allow us to get more accurate results. And then it also, frankly, you know, it gives us a boost in publicity.
Mm-hmm.
It gives us, you know, more national recognition so that we can publicize our work better.
And so when you say it enables you to do more work, I'm wondering, what is that work? If I came to your lab, are people doing experiments? Are they, what happens at your place every day?
Yeah, great question. It's a huge variety. And that's why I started when I said I'm hiring all these different kinds of people. We do a large range of different types of work. So my lab is both computational and experimental, which means that we have people who have more computer science backgrounds. One of my tenure homes is the Department of Computational Biology.
Wow.
And so we are designing proteins computationally, and we're trying to understand the shape of proteins and how they evolved. And so that all happens computationally. So some people are typing away at the computer all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have chemists, and we have molecular biologists and microbiologists, people with a whole variety of training trying to understand both the chemistry and the biology of these proteins interacting with the cell.
I was going to say, you're working to disable these pumps, at least this is what I've read,
mm-hmm.
that are inside of bacteria.
Yeah.
And these pumps push away antibiotics that want to come in that would get rid of them.
Yeah.
Am I describing that accurately?
That's exactly right. So when you think of antibiotic resistance, there are sort of three main ways that bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. So the bacteria, these infections, are evolving resistance, and you've got a number of antibiotics. And when you think about how the antibiotics work, each antibiotic binds a target in the cell.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when it binds that target, it's killing the cell in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So the bacteria can evolve to change that target so it won't, so the individual antibiotic won't bind the target. But there are lots of antibiotics and lots of targets. So in that instance, you could imagine adding a different type of antibiotic and you would still be able to take care of that infection.
How scary of a place are we now, medically speaking, when it comes to these bacteria that are so resistant to antibiotics? How big is the concern? How big is the crunch that we're facing medically in this country right now?
So I don't do these prognoses, but a British group has said that by 2050, antimicrobial resistant infection will outpace cancer as a cause of death.
Oh, my gosh.
So more than 10 million deaths a year. We're currently, I think, at about 700,000 deaths per year in the whole world.
And this is happening. Why? Why are the bacteria becoming so resistant to bacteria, to the antibiotics?
So it's a good question. And people aren't totally sure. We know maybe more about what the mechanism is, where once a bacteria develops resistance, it's very able to share that resistance with bacteria around it through lateral gene transfer, taking that gene that's making it resistant and giving it away to the next bacteria next door. But why it's happening, you know, it seems to have to do, many people believe that it has to do with the overuse of antibiotics, that when we have low-level exposure to antibiotics in the groundwater, in the soil, because we're using it so much both for human health, but also, frankly, for agriculture.
Ah.
And right, and we put it in our soaps now. You know, everyone wants antimicrobial dish detergents and whatnot. And so having these low-level exposures gives the bacteria an opportunity to evolve the resistance when it's not at the level that would kill it.
So we're doing this to ourselves to some degree, then, it sounds like, is what you're saying.
That's the belief.
Yeah. If you could wave your magic wand as this big famous researcher now and change our culture to better deal with this, would you get rid of antibacterial soaps? Would you?
And the government is already starting to do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's already been legislation in place to lessen the antibiotics in soaps. And I hope that the next stage is to lessen it, and this may be a controversial statement, but in agriculture.
That's the big crunch, though, right? Because
the
farmers want to keep their cattle and their everybody healthy so they can sell them.
Well, it not just keeps them healthy, right? It actually fattens them up.
Okay. Okay.
So...
And what kind of response does the agricultural industry give when people like you suggest that maybe we need to be thinking about this?
I haven't said this so publicly yet. I'll let you know how the hate mail is.
but clearly, it's a conversation needs to happen.
I'm not the first person to say this. I didn't make it up. My research is on coming up with specific ways of disabling antibiotic resistance. I'm not a public policy expert. It's just my understanding that it seems that the agriculture industry is using a tremendous amount of antibiotics.
So I'm wondering, too, to what extent do you feel pressure to get this work done and get it done fairly quickly if these numbers of people who are dying from these infections is only going up as the years progress? Does that put pressure on you to snap your fingers and solve this thing pretty quickly?
I am completely incentive aligned. If I could solve antibiotic resistance today or tomorrow, right, that would be great for the world. It would be great for me getting tenure. Like, there's nothing bad would happen to me if I could solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all upside. But it's hard. And thank goodness I'm not the only person working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
People around the country also?
People around the country.
Around the
people
world.
Around the world. There are lots of, this is because it's such a pressing public health crisis, you know, there's a lot of growing interest in it.
But you're focusing on these pumps that are inside a bacteria.
Yeah.
Is that something of a unique approach to going after this issue?
Yeah, it's something of a unique approach. And the particular way that I'm approaching it, by actually targeting the part of the protein that's in the membrane, is unique. That's what these grants have been for.
Where did you get the idea from? Where did that come to you? How did you get that idea?
You know, I've been working on these outer membrane proteins separately from antibiotic resistance. I have all kinds of ideas of what you can do with these membrane proteins, with making them be biosensors or using them for cancer or vaccines, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that it's the amazing environment of the other scientists at KU, where I was having conversations with other biochemists and microbiologists, and they were talking about this pressing need for dealing with antibiotic resistance, and a light bulb kind of went off and said, you know, I think that something that I have in my lab could work on that. And we started playing with a protein that I had made for something else that was already in the freezer. And immediately we got results where my technician came to me and said, you know, we're going to need to get a different control because it's even making the control more susceptible to antibiotics. And I said, oh, well, that's actually...
That's good.
You know, okay, that's good. Like, oh, it's working. It's working super well without even having to optimize the system. And that's where we started.
So can you give us a sense how close you are to solving this puzzle? And do you see an answer within reach here, or are you years away?
Far. I mean, so, well...
But what you just described to me sounded pretty encouraging.
Yeah, it's very encouraging, but... But you have to understand, I guess, number one, there's the scientific aspect that I'm trying to optimize and make work in a relevant system. So I'm currently, you know, there are all kinds of sort of very laboratory-based things that I'm doing that wouldn't work if I was doing it to humans in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. But number two is that then there's, you know, preclinical testing where you have to figure out, is this, would this be toxic to humans? And then there's clinical trials and different phases of clinical trials. I mean, and those on their own can take 10 or 15 years. So bringing a new drug to market is a really long process because you have to be so careful that you don't have side effects and that you don't damage human health in the process.
Is that what you're aiming for here, Dr. Slutsky, is a new drug of some kind?
So that the hope would be that we could have these, what I'll call antibiotic potentiators, things that make antibiotics work better,
mm-hmm.
right? The idea is if you can stop the bacteria from pushing out the antibiotics, and the antibiotics will stay in the cell and they'll be able to reach their target. So the idea would be that you could have this antibiotic potentiator, this thing that makes the bacteria more susceptible to antibiotic along with the antibiotic.
I see.
That it would sort of be a 1-2 punch.
A second pill you take with the antibiotic itself.
Yeah. Or yeah. If it's a topical infection, a cream that you put on or you know, whatever it is.
Oh, I see. So how many years away might this be? Or do you even know?
20?
20 years. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
It's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Are you a patient person or an impatient person by nature?
Impatient.
I was going to say, how do you deal? You're working in a world that requires patience, mm-hmm. and I would be going nuts because I'm an impatient guy too.
Well, I see all of the. I'm impatient with all of the near term problems. So instead of seeing it as my, you know, I'm impatient because I need to solve antibiotic resistance, I can be impatient about making sure that my protein binds the right target, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a much more near-term problem that I can be impatient about, but that we can probably solve over the course of a few months.
Is a lot of the work you're doing just hit and miss, trial and error? You try this, you try that, and you're just doing it over and over and over again? Is that what your work is?
Yeah. The reassuring thing that was told to me when I was an undergraduate at Princeton, so my advisor, Michael Hecht, said, you know, if you worked on an assembly line and you were going to be putting car doors on cars and it only worked 1 out of 17 times, you're not very good at your job.
Mm-hmm.
And this job isn't probably going to work out for you. But if your scientific experiments work 1 out of 17 times. And when I say that, I don't mean that it's not reproducible. I mean that to find something that's reproducible, you find it only 1 out of 17 trials, you're doing amazing.
Hmm.
And part of the trick as a professor who's training lots of students is to help teach that to them.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's not just my impatience, it's my students' impatience.
I'm wondering what you thought, Dr. Slutsky, when you received this $2.3 mm-hmm. million grant from the National Institutes of Health. That's a huge grant in terms of what the government typically does.
Yeah.
Obviously, a vote of confidence in what you're doing. What was your reaction?
I was ecstatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I was totally ecstatic. And I just immediately wanted to celebrate with my lab, with all the trainees, and because it's so much of their work that makes this award possible. It's all of their preliminary data that you put in the grant that they say, oh, this is convincing.
Just a final point. I mean, you're going at this problem of stopping bacteria from resisting antibiotics in one direction. Why can't we just keep developing new antibiotics?
So it's a great question. There are a number of problems, some of which are technical and chemical, but there's also a market reason why you can't develop new antibiotics, which is that in order to develop these new antibiotics, I told you that for any new drug, you are going to need to have, you know, these long preclinical testing, clinical trials, and that's extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who invest in that are drug companies, but they do that because they need to make the money back. And they need to make the money back by ultimately doctors prescribing that drug, people buying that drug, the insurance companies paying for that drug. So it's a whole ecosystem.
Huh.
And if you have a new antibiotic that nothing has developed resistance to, then there's a lot of pressure to not prescribe that antibiotic
oh.
because you want to save it only for the last resort situations. And that's not a good economic situation.
Dr. Joanna Slusky from the University of Kansas, thank you for coming over.
Thanks so much.
We're all
for
rooting
me.
For you. Come back and let us know how it's going, okay?
I'll let you know. Thank
good
you.
Luck with your work.
Thanks.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Look who's here. Brian McTavish is in the house to talk about some cool stuff to do on your weekends. And welcome back. How are you?
It is I.
This is your big weekend, Kansas City Comic-Con.
Well, it's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, not to confuse the listening audience. Well, it's too late. I probably already confused you. Yeah. But in February, we have the Planet Comic-Con, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the really, really big shoe. This is the really big shoe. This is kind of the upstart, maybe no longer an upstart show called Kansas City Comic-Con, which I heartily will enjoy myself all weekend. And we're playing the Superman theme. It's 3 days of funny book fun, Friday, Saturday, Sunday at Bartle Hall.
Because for listeners who don't know, you're a huge comic
book
guy.
Oh, yes. I want to get into Superman before we leave this wonderful topic, but I anticipate your question. What will I be doing at the con this weekend?
What will you be doing?
Well, thanks for asking.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to find a nice, affordable copy of Fantastic Four number 49.
Is that right?
Now,
are you serious?
Yes, I am.
Because?
Because I have most of them, and I need a number 8, which is too pricey right now. I think I can nail down a 49. It's the second appearance of the Silver Surfer and Galactus.
And this has been on your list for a while.
It's been on my list for
you guys.
38 years.
This is how you roll.
That's how I roll. Now, when I say nice and affordable, there's a conflict, because affordable is what it means. Nice, I want a nice one, but how nice can I get, and how cheap can I get it?
Because the price depends very much on the quality and how the comic book is rated by
experts.
It
depends, Steve, principally on my ability to hornswoggle someone into giving me a good deal. Anyway, why were we playing the Superman theme? Let's very briefly but meaningfully delve into that.
Yes.
Not only will there be comic book fans like me and comic creators and cosplayers Friday, Saturday, Sunday at Bartle Hall at Kansas City Comic Con, but you'll also have lots of screen celebs, many, 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 but most notably Margot Kidder.
Wow.
And other cast members.
That's cool.
Yeah, Lois Lane from the original Superman movie franchise, including Jeff East, who plays the teenage Superman-to-be in the great movie starring Christopher Reeve.
Okay, that's a good one to start off with this week.
Oh, yeah.
What do we have here?
Ha ha, Young Frankenstein.
Ah.
It's the musical comedy, very successful on Broadway a few years ago, based on the classic Mel Brooks movie from 1974, also named famously Young Frankenstein. It's on stage tonight through Saturday night. Hmm. And again, there's a 2:00 in the afternoon matinee on Sunday at the White Theater at the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City. Okay, so the great lines you loved in the movie, you will get here. A very talented local cast under the direction of Missy Koontz is going to tackle this thing, and they're going to keep the funny lines in, like, put the candle back. Like, yes, yes, he was my boyfriend. Or maybe, what hump? Or my favorite, wait, where are you going? I was going to make espresso. Remember that one?
I do.
And that's just the tip of the comic electrode. So Thursday, today, Friday, Saturday, and again on Sunday at the White Theater at the Jewish Community Center. Laughs aplenty, courtesy of Mr. Mel Brooks.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 comic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Let's turn to a comedian here, Dimitri Martin.
Yes, let us, because he is a very funny fellow. Dimitri Martin, a stand-up comedian who is on his, I would call it, a rewardingly uncomfortable Let's Get Awkward tour. That's his name for it. And his specialty is to be both kind of an observational comic in the traditional sense, but highly inventive in terms of his intellectual take on things. Take, for example, let's listen just for a moment or three to Dimitri Martin talking about how just simple personal introductions can just be so silly.
I think we have a new clip here, but we're going to listen to it anyway.
Well, let's
here we
do
go.
That one instead.
I like playing guitar when I do my jokes. I actually started in guitar quite a while ago as a street performer. It was difficult, though, because I was in the suburbs. On a cul-de-sac. Not a lot of foot traffic, but... There's a store in my neighborhood called Futon World. I love that name, Futon World. It makes me think of a magical place that becomes less comfortable over time.
That's Dimitri Martin.
Right. So
there you go.
He incorporates some of his musical abilities. He'll probably even do some funny, larger-than-life sketches. Very talented, gifted guy. He got his start as a staff writer on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He eventually wound up on The Daily Show. Now he's a best-selling humor author and just generally all around funny, awkwardly
8 o'clock
funny
Friday
guy.
At the Folly Theater.
Do it. Absolutely.
I've never talked back. I've never slept late. I've never sat down when told to stand straight. I've never let go and gone with the flow. And don't even know really why. I've never asked questions or taken a dare. I've never worn clothes that might make people stare. I've never...
Please explain this one.
Now, do you remember, Steve, the 1992 Whoopi Goldberg movie Sister Act?
Kinda.
It was a big hit. This is the musical stage version. There's lots of laughs. It's a crazy setup. A high-spirited gal witnesses a murder and needs a place to lay low until the culprit is caught.
Yes.
So what does she do? She joins a nunnery. She's in the convent, and laughter and disco dancing ensue. She's a singer, and she teaches the nuns to sing and belt it out. Now, this song we're listening to, though, this is special because even though it's a funny show, this is the life I never led, and as arguably schmaltzy as aspects of this show might be to some cynically minded people, this is a great Broadway ballad. Okay, it's inspirational, it's brave, it's strong. It's the scene in which a young nun questions her future, questions the decision she has made to be a nun, right?
Right.
And, you know, it's brave, it's strong, it's a seize-the-day thing, it's impressive, and it's worth the price of admission. So check out Sister Act, if only for this Broadway moment.
And finally today... This is P-Lander Z.
Yes, it is. Before we
I've
get
never
into
heard of him.
That's why I bring you this stuff,
yes.
So you can hear him.
Before, ouch.
Before we get into that, I want to... It's going to hurt so good this weekend at the record bar. That's P-Lander Z. But I just want to mention real quick, I don't think I mentioned that Sister Act, which we were just talking about, is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Barn Players Community Theater in Mission. So there's that.
Tell me about P-Lander Z in about 10 seconds.
Okay, P-Lander Z. They're the Japanese action comic punk band... based in New York City. Are you ready? Yeah, I'm ready. 9 o'clock tonight at the Record Bar.
That's it. Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, Brian.
A screamingly good time tonight.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, see what shorter enrollment periods and less funding means for folks who rely on the Affordable Care Act. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.